it Bridgegate. Good morning. We're live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead this hour, why the lighting of a downtown city bridge in rainbow colors has sparked negative national attention over the governor's approach to equality in Florida. Give us a call during this Pride Month, the number 549-2937. Then later we'll tell you why activists are rallying in downtown Jacksonville this morning over the issue of teaching critical race theory in public schools. But first this hour, the rainbow lights are back up on the city's Acosta Bridge this week. This after a flap over lighting up the span for Pride Month that has gained negative national attention. It's the latest culture war controversy impacting Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, leading some to ask if he and his administration are homophobic, just as he tees up a run for re-election. His opponent, Agriculture Commissioner Nikki Fried, a Democrat, the highest ranking Democrat in the state, actually came to Jacksonville yesterday and posted a video near the Acosta Bridge talking about this issue. So what's the latest with it? And what are some insights we can gain? Nate Monroe has been writing about it in the Florida Times Union, and he's on the line. Hi, Nate.
Hey, Melissa.
Thanks for being with us. And give us a call, everyone, as we talk about Pride Month, the Acosta Bridge, and more. 549-2937. Give us a call. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. And our Facebook page is open. Well, Nate, before we get into some of the observations you make in your column today about the governor, let's begin with what we know about this. This goes beyond Jacksonville, by the way. So in Jacksonville, of course, JTA, the Jacksonville Transportation Authority, has been lighting up the Acosta Bridge for all kinds of observances and events and memorials. And in keeping with that, they lit it up for Pride Month, LGBTQ Pride, in rainbow colors. The state ordered them to take the colors down because they said they weren't in compliance with regulations. And at the same time, two other bridges in different parts of the state, one in Sarasota and one in Pinellas County, they wanted to light up their bridges in rainbow colors. And FDOT, the Florida Department of Transportation, told them they couldn't, that they were denied permission. So let's begin with what we know about how this all played out, because I know you and I both have spoken with JTA about this, and it's my understanding that JTA didn't even ask permission to light up the bridge. They just have been in the habit of doing this for all kinds of things and went ahead and did it thinking it wouldn't be a problem, and then ran into some blowback from the state. Can you begin there and tell us a little bit more about what we've been able to find out?
Sure, and I would say that sequence of events is, about right. JTA has what's called like a standing utility permit. So it's not, the process isn't that JTA goes to FDOT every single time they want to light the bridge up with a theme. They have this permit, and the understanding is they just kind of operate under it and everything just sort of fine. The head of the local FDOT office sits on the JTA board of directors as an ex officio member. They interface with FDOT all the time. This isn't, the lighting stuff really should not have been a secret to FDOT. Mm-hmm. JTA has been posting monthly calendars of upcoming light displays. There was a process where people could request certain themes to honor, you know, holidays or nonprofits or causes. So, I mean, this was not the idea that FDOT sort of swooped in to cancel this. Very bizarre. Now, you credited this correctly, that the governor's office and FDOT have said this was a permitting issue, that it needed to come down because it was out of compliance. There are kind of two complications there. The first is that JTA has lit the bridge up with themes that were out of compliance previously. I think
quite a few,
at this point,
yeah,
quite a few times. Most infamously, I think at this point, in Clemson, orange and purple, when we drafted Trevor Lawrence, that came at the request of the mayor. Again, there was a big to-do about it. JTA posting all over social media about it. The mayor was. This very out-of-compliance lighting display was not a problem. And some of the few public records that we were able to get our hands on around this issue yesterday point actually to a different reason that prompted FDOT to get JTA to take these lights down on Pride Month. They claimed in an email that they had received, quote, several complaints of an unspecified nature about the Pride lights. And that appears to actually have been what prompted FDOT to have JTA take the lights down, not a compliance issue. They cited the permit after noting that they had gotten these complaints. Even the reason they provided is contradicted by some of the records we have. There are, unfortunately, no records of these complaints. FDOT did not take any of them down, did not take any contact information. We have no indication of the number of these complaints, where they came from, if they were internal complaints. We just kind of know what we have from this one short email. And I would say that's the one little bit of kind of behind-the-scenes maneuvering that didn't quite come out until a bit later yesterday.
It's 549-2937. Give us a call. You know, if this were a simple matter of back and forth over one bridge, it'd be one thing. But as you point out, and as other journalists have reported, there were two other requests in other parts of the state to light up bridges with rainbow colors. They were denied, which shocked the local officials, one in Sarasota, one in Pinellas. And as you narrate in your column, the Governor DeSantis, has established a pattern of actions that appear to be hostile to LGBTQ Florida residents, the transgender law about transgender girls and women not being allowed to compete in high school girls and college women's sports. He did that on the first day of Pride Month at a private school here in Jacksonville that has a reputation for harboring child sexual abusers. He vetoed nearly $1 million out of the state budget for mental health services intended to help survivors of the 2016 massacre at the Pulse nightclub in Orlando. Yeah, so there's been a pattern here that has certainly upset LGBTQ Florida residents, to say the least. And what's interesting to note, going beyond their legitimate hurt and upset, is that Agriculture Commissioner Nikki Fried, who is running in the Democratic primary to unseat DeSantis, has been talking about this and noted that not only has the governor, according to her, denied these rainbow lights through his state agency, FDOT, that he also prevented the lighting of the state capitol in Tallahassee to be orange for gun violence awareness. So Governor DeSantis, whether it's LGBT issues or other issues, is running a culture war campaign and doubling down on appeals to a very conservative base in Florida, which might be enough to get him over the line as he seeks re-election. And he is certainly positioning himself for a 2024 presidential run should President Trump not run again. The thing is, though, Nate, is that these issues, particularly the issue of LGBT equality, there's bipartisan support for same-sex marriage and equality more broadly. America has decided this. That's what makes this so bizarre. Most people have moved on from this whole thing, and it's settled for most Americans.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's true. I would maybe caveat that I think transgender people and athletics is a kind of new front in the culture war that Republicans are hoping to exploit. I don't know that public opinion is quite as, settled on transgender issues.
I would agree with that, but certainly yeah. Lighting up a bridge isn't offensive to most. Yeah.
Sure, yeah, 100%. And I think, that's the sort of bizarre thing about this. you referenced Sarasota and Pinellas. Those are, I mean, two separate FDOT offices oversee Pinellas and Sarasota. So with Jacksonville, you've got three different FDOT offices that just so happen to act hostily toward these pride light displays. And a governor who is very insistent, very, very insistent that he had nothing to do with this, that his office had nothing to do with this, that, you know, these were, at least in the Jacksonville case, a local decision. It's not really clear what happened in Pinellas or Sarasota, and it's not clear if those decisions will be reversed now that ours was reversed. And the governor even claims that the decision for the Jacksonville FDOT to reverse itself was not his doing. So, I mean, he's taking sort of the most extreme hands-off approach possible. And even in his telling of it, I mean, their statement yesterday didn't say anything about wanting to affirm the governor's commitment to LGBTQ people. He didn't say anything about, wanting Florida to, be a place where people can be assured everyone's treated equally. I mean, it was just this very, the lights will be back up. That's kind of all there was. I certainly don't think there is a question that the governor is profoundly uncomfortable with gay and transgender issues. Whether he is openly hostile toward them, maybe there's a debate to be had there, but he is certainly uncomfortable with it, does not go out of his way to embrace any of these issues. And obviously, pride light displays are not something he has much of an opinion about one way or another if you take his office at face value.
Lots of calls. Let us know your thoughts about the Bridgegate flap here in Jacksonville and reverberations around the state and the country. 549-2937. Jay on the South Side. Hi, Jay.
How are you?
Good. Go ahead.
My only comment is I don't see how this is very surprising because, I mean, he did just pass some legislation, and in order to bring something to the forefront or put in as a poster child for his legislation, he had to go to Connecticut to go find an athlete to voice his complaint. And there was no real complaint of that nature anywhere else around in this area. He didn't have anywhere else to pull an example from. And he just, before that, passed some legislation, a riot act to keep people safe if there were any kind of protests or anything else, but there was never anything that happened to need that. And we already have legislation that would have done something. It's all window dressing for whatever he wants to do in 2024. And for 2024, how can you be president and you had a pay-for-play ideal going for vaccination? And in the middle of a pandemic, you're trying to play with Twitter? I mean, come on now. Thank you very much.
All right. Yeah, Jay, and you're referring to a few different things there, the transgender issue. He did bring a student from Connecticut to that news conference at a private school in Jacksonville. Let the record show less than a dozen transgender female athletes in Florida have even applied to play sports in the last decade or so. It's literally less than a dozen kids. And then you mentioned the governor attacking big tech in the wake of Twitter and Facebook banning former President Trump for inciting a violent insurrection and inciting people to try to overthrow the government on January 6th at the U.S. Capitol. So lots there in his comment, Nate, but I think it's fair to say people who've watched this governor for some time do see all of these moves in the context of his presidential ambitions, and the question is, will it work for him? Will this work?
Sure. The caller was exactly right. You and I actually talked about this on a different show last week. The governor is trying to run a sort of Trumpian government in exile out of the governor's mansion. He's taking national issues national issues where there are some conservative grievance politics to be exploited, and he's turning that into state legislation and making a big show about it. Getting a sort of Connecticut poster child to come down here to you know, tout this transgender athletics bill. I mean, it just kind of shows, like, a lot of this stuff has nothing to do with Florida and the needs of Floridians.
Which are, I mean, which are really considerable, by the way, which are acute. Yeah. Yeah. We're getting, instead of bread and butter issues, governance thing, you know, the kinds of things that would help people with needs, we're getting all this culture war stuff out of Tallahassee. Okay, let's go to a few more calls. Guy in St. Augustine. Hi, Guy.
Yeah, good morning. I'm a lifelong Republican that can't believe that DeSantis can't keep his foot out of his mouth, whether it started with not promoting the wearing of masks. The bridge is just the latest issue showing where he really, where his heart is and where he stands. And I can't believe, and it's embarrassing for me as a Republican, that he can be so one-sided that he can't look at other people's needs other than his own desires. And I'll take the rest of the answer off the air, but it's a shame.
Guy, thanks.
Have a good day.
As I mentioned earlier, Nate, these types of issues are divisive, but there is so much bipartisan support for LGBTQ equality. 70% in the U.S. support same-sex marriage now, including a majority of Republicans. And so when the governor doubles down on these issues, he's really appealing to a minority of Republicans.
He is. I should emphasize here again that the governor's office claims he had no involvement with
That's
the
right.
bridge decision. But, you know, a point that I make in my column about this, and of course they consider this to be profoundly unfair, but I don't. You know, if there's a different governor in office who has not shown this kind of antipathy toward gay and transgender people, do a few complaints about a pride bridge prompt all of this action by the local FDOT? You know, probably not, right? Like, the governor sets the tone in this state. You know, it would be absurd to think that if JTA had lit the bridge up in honor of, you know, Veterans Day, and they got a few complaints about it, I don't think the local FDOT office would have been frantically calling JTA to take the lights down because they were out of compliance.
They called and emailed several JTA employees, even the agency CEO. And you interviewed Equality Florida, a spokesman there, saying he believes there are very few coincidences with this administration that this is something that exists throughout the administration. The reason I bring that up is we're getting emails from listeners saying that we shouldn't blame the governor for something that was decided by a low-level bureaucrat in the state government.
Yeah, that's their story. I'm not sure they've provided anything beyond an insistence that that's what happened. You know, again, even their initial explanation for why this happened sort of fell apart. It was not a permitting issue. It was apparently some complaints of an unspecified nature. You know, before we got that record, we hadn't heard that anything about complaints from the governor's office or from FDOT until we got that record. So I'm inclined to think that, you know, maybe everything they tell us is not always right all the time.
Lots of tweets coming into the show. Here's just one. It's truly sad when our leadership in Florida wants all of us to be heterosexual, white, gun-carrying men who know what is best for all Americans. This is not my America. Taylor in Jacksonville. Go ahead, Taylor.
Hey, I'm trying to talk about a sticky situation that involves the government. State statute 112.66. It involves all local public employees, teachers, firefighters, you name it, and it discriminates against them because of their age, young age, and disability.
All right, Taylor. Well, you know what? Let me put you on hold, and we'll get your number and follow up with you on another day about that. I'm going to put you on hold and get your contact information just because that's a little off topic from what we have a lot of other calls. Thanks, Taylor. You're on hold now. We'll get your number. Ryan on the north side. Hi, Ryan.
Hi, Melissa. So I actually called earlier this on Tuesday on the Sinatis thing.
That was just the other day. So it's been an interesting Pride Month, hasn't it?
It really has. I just wanted to comment on how exasperated I kind of am from the governor and just the general right, unfortunately. I know that there are more and more moderate Republicans that are supposedly, quote-unquote, fine with people being gay. But there seems to be this dissonance of, like, this cognitive dissonance of, I'm okay with it, but I only think you should sort of have rights, basically. Mm. So that's all I wanted to add to that.
Sure. And, you know...
I also just kind of want to point out, if you are on that side and you feel that you are supportive, then I would, if you're on the right, that is, I would like to encourage you to call people out when they are spewing hate. And that is all.
Thank you, Ryan. Yeah. Nate, you know, this whole thing... Let's just give a moment to honor the fact that when that bridge was lit up, that was legitimizing a community that has faced millennia of discrimination, fear, persecution, sometimes being thrown in jail simply for being who they are, not allowed to marry, not full participants in society. So lighting up the bridge was giving that community legitimacy and representation. And that was extremely meaningful. And so in Jacksonville, the lights were seen. And I think that's why it became such a flap, because in the other cities, they wouldn't even let them put up the lights. They just denied the request. But here, JTA didn't ask. They just put the lights up, too much rejoicing. And then to have them taken down after they'd been up for a little while, it sort of rubs salt in the wound even more.
Sure. And I think a point that's important to make here, you know, the Sarasota and Pinellas issues happened last week. I mean, those things, the governor's office should have been aware of those denials. That generated controversy and media coverage, and, you know, Charlie Crist, who wants to run against DeSantis, got involved and, you know, had a few quotes in one of the newspaper stories on it. I mean, it's not like that was a non-event, and the governor's office did nothing about it. And so I'm just a little bit dubious about this idea that like the governor's office just, you know, they're just willfully sort of ignorant of these things. Like, I don't think that's the case. Equality Florida, when I talk to them, I mean, that's basically, I think, their position that, you know, these denials are happening. They all sort of have some eerie echoes of one another. You know, we're at three different offices that publicly had this issue. I don't know if there maybe were more denials we just haven't heard about yet. I mean, it is symbolic. And that's sort of part of why it's bizarre that they can't just go up.
Joe tweets the show, "The end game here is the vilification of marginalized people. What is most terrifying about these divides is that it is typical of authoritarian movements to attempt to transform myths about the other into reality through social policy." Okay, so, you actually say in your writing, you believe these episodes disgrace the office of the governor, and you're not just referring to the bridge issues, but some of the other controversies that have dogged his first administration.
Yes. Again, if he were bothered by the perception of his handling of LGBTQ issues, I mean, it would be easy to even put out a statement about his values. And he won't do that. I mean, again, here we were yesterday, the governor seeking to demonstrate that he had nothing to do with it. It's not like he turned around and said, "I want people to know that I do value gay and transgender people." They sort of unceremoniously allow JTA to flip the lights back on.
Yeah.
I think at some point when you act like a troll and then you suddenly ask people to not, you know, to believe that you weren't being a troll this one time, it just becomes, you know, there's just not a lot of credulity there.
It stands in contrast, too, to the U.S. Senate passing a bill this week officially designated the Pulse nightclub site in Orlando as a national memorial. Senator Rick Scott, a potential opponent of DeSantis in 2024, actually introduced that bill. Marco Rubio, also up for re-election in this state, supports these kinds of moves. And so even very conservative opponents of Ron DeSantis are on the other side publicly, demonstratively using their power in the Senate on this issue.
I mean, I think your last caller made a good point, which is that, you know, most LGBTQ issues are, you know, pretty popular, and politicians in both parties often do are at pains to demonstrate that, you know, they're on the pride side. But, you know, that often falls apart. I mean, even, you know, Donald Trump claimed he was, you know, pro-LGBTQ, but his White House implemented, you know, like federal hiring policies that were discriminatory against gay and transgender people. So, I mean, there is a kind of rhetoric reality split that happens sometimes. DeSantis isn't really trying, so I guess in a perverse way you can give him credit for that.
I would encourage everyone to read Nate's work and all of the work of the reporters in the Florida Times Union as we continue to cover it. Always great to have your insights. Nate Monroe, thank you so much.
Melissa, thank you.
And much more still ahead later in the hour. Some summer listening from local talent. It's our Jacksonville Music Experience, which is expanding this month, and we'll tell you about it. But up next.
Proposal by the governor is simply an effort to whitewash, sanitize, and cover up history.
Activists rally downtown this morning as the State Board of Ed meets here, looking to ban the teaching of critical race theory in Florida schools. That's next. Well, activists are rallying this morning at FSCJ's downtown campus here in Jacksonville. They're protesting plans by the State Board of Education, who are meeting here as we speak, to adopt new standards for teaching history and civics in the Sunshine State to public school students. Recently, Governor Ron DeSantis said he and educational leaders in Florida would ban the teaching of critical race theory. I spoke about it with one of the protest leaders, Ben Frazier, of the Northside Coalition of Jacksonville. Hi, Ben. Good to talk to you. Thanks for being with us.
Hey, glad to be back again.
So the Northside Coalition of Jacksonville, which you lead, has been involved for a long time in the movement to not only take down Confederate statues around town, but to change the names of local schools with ties to the Confederacy. That is now happening, but then there's still this issue of how to raise money to pay for the name changes, and you have some updates on that, yes?
Yes, I think right now, as it stands, we're about $180,000 short, but it has been a tremendous past week and a half, in terms of people coming together as one city to address this issue honestly and straightforwardly. We've got to do it like they used to say, put the cash on the barrelhead. We've got to put our money where our mouths are. So my suggestion, quite simply and straightforwardly, is it is now time to, as they used to say, pony up. It's time for us to raise this money. We need to get it from individual donors. That means you, that means you, and that means you. And it's also, we need to get the money from the public sector. There's got to be some money somewhere that the mayor could show us. We also need to try to get the captains of industry in this town, the private sector,
the big ballers and the shot callers to help us out. Shot Khan has done a tremendous part in picking up the cost on uniforms. That is the lion's share of this cost. These high schools have got 36 different uniforms to pay for. And the middle schools have about 15 different sports uniforms to pay for. Not to mention the marquee settings or the gym floors, logos, the chorus group uniforms as well. So there are a lot of different things that we're going to take care of. But we just need to come together and make it happen. It's time for us to move forward and to all put in what we can afford to put in.
Right. And people can go to jackspef.org to donate to that fund. Now, let me ask you as a follow-up. The State Board of Education will be meeting in Jacksonville this month at FSCJ to adopt new standards around the teaching of history and civics. This is controversial. The governor has called for a ban on the teaching in public schools of what's known as critical race theory. In other words, looking at American history through the lens of systemic racism and how that has affected our public policies, the way we spend taxpayer money, our criminal justice system, and other things. The Northside Coalition of Jacks is protesting these changes. Tell us why.
Certainly. The problem here is that this proposal by the governor is simply an effort to whitewash, sanitize, and cover up history. We believe that it is imperative that teachers be allowed to teach the truth. This proposal, Melissa, is a shameful effort on the part of the governor to actually brainwash public school students. He's using it to promote what amounts to be a conservative propaganda campaign, his own personal political agenda. I think it's disgusting that the governor is using the public school system as a launching pad for his own political purposes. Again, we think that teachers should simply be allowed to teach the truth.
And when you say brainwash, what do you mean by that? Is taking some items of history, teaching our history off the table, brainwashing? For example, the Tulsa massacre of 100 years ago. There's been a lot of discussion about that in recent weeks, the 100th anniversary of that. Most of us weren't taught about that in school. We should have been. Is leaving things out of the teaching brainwashing, or just cherry-picking what kids are taught and what they're not taught?
Let's not get hung up on semantics. They're not teaching the truth. And when you're not teaching the truth, it means you're brainwashing because you're telling a different story. Teachers should be teaching these students about the horrors of history, the real life stories like the Trail of Tears. The Trail of Tears is a story about ethnic cleansing and genocide. They need to be taught the stories about racial lynching and white supremacy. These are true stories, and these stories are not being told. So what stories are being told, and why doesn't the governor want these stories told? He doesn't want these stories told because he doesn't want you to bring up issues about race. He's trying to push the issue of racism, discrimination, and other racial issues to the back burner. That is propaganda. We disagree with that. We believe the lessons about colonialism, white supremacy, and racial oppression should be taught. In addition to that, classrooms should be culturally responsible and responsive. We think it is important that our students be taught the value and importance of critical thinking. They should be taught to evaluate, examine, and review history, history that is directly interconnected with issues of race. And if you're not doing that, you are trying to brainwash students in an entirely different way.
What's your response to the governor saying that critical race theory, and I'm quoting him, will teach students to hate themselves and each other.
That statement is a clear-cut example of what I call propaganda. In the words of James Baldwin, not everything that can be faced can be changed. But until it is faced, nothing can be changed. The governor's plan reflects a refusal to acknowledge that Black history is American history, that Native American history is American history, or that immigrant history is American history. We say candidly and straightforwardly, teachers should be allowed to teach the truth.
Ben Frazier, Northside Coalition of Jacksonville, thanks for your time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, Jacksonville has been selected as the host city of the inaugural Street League Skateboarding World Championship coming up this fall. Now, this isn't going to be held at Kona Skate Park, which is a legendary place in its own right. Instead, all the action is at downtown Riverfront Plaza, the former site of the Jacksonville Landing. Alan Verlander is CEO of Airstream Ventures, and he's on the line to tell us more about it. Hey, Alan, good morning.
Hey, Melissa, how you doing?
I'm great, thanks. This is so exciting. The Street League Skateboarding World Championship coming to the Riverfront. What can we expect?
It is. You know, we've been working on this for over a year. They came and Street League Skateboarding and Throw One Entertainment came way before the pandemic and looked at it. And so we've been working on this event for a long time. And I think, as I said the other day, I think if we are going to grow as a sports city, we have to embrace all different types of sports at the highest level. And certainly, you know, the Ramos family and what they've done at Kona Skate Park has been amazing in keeping the sport alive. And now we have a chance to host what would be the Super Bowl of skateboarding here, right on the riverfront. I think it's going to be a spectacular venue. We're just excited about it. It's going to put Jacksonville on an international stage, and that's what we want to do as we're trying to build the city.
This is coming up the weekend of November 13th. The world's top 24 skateboarders will be here on the riverfront. You're going to transform this place into a skate park. That sounds like a big endeavor.
It is. You know, it's definitely something that we got to have a lot of proper planning for. But we're gonna bring basically 6,000 temporary seats that'll be kind of laid out in an arena type of venue with skateboarding apparatuses and tricks and all of that kind of stuff right in the middle. And we'll have high-end hospitality opportunities. And so it will look and feel like it's permanent, but it'll come in a few days before. We'll put it all together, and then it'll go out a few days after, kind of like we do with the stadium with Florida Georgia. So, but it's going to give us as a city an opportunity to showcase all the different things and the way that we can be creative in bringing massive events to our community. And I think this is, you know, a lot has been done in the past, and this is just going to continue that movement.
Now, I did not realize this, but skateboarding is making its debut Olympic appearance this summer at the Olympics in Tokyo. That's pretty cool.
It is, and that's one of the great things is you're going to watch, and we're going to watch, all these great skateboarders on NBC over, you know, July and August compete for a gold medal. Those same skaters are going to be in Jacksonville in November competing what the skaters would tell you is a more coveted crown as the world being the world champion. And so, you know, I think we've got a real opportunity to show people that Jacksonville, you know, you look at skateboarding, you go to a skate park here in Jacksonville, there's all different types of people skateboarding, you know? Mm-hmm. And so I think it's a real opportunity to unify our city, bring a unique event, and showcase what the city has to offer.
That's right. There is such a tradition here. Kona Skate Park in Arlington is the world's oldest continuously operating skate park. It has attracted the world's top skateboarders, including Tony Hawk. It's just a great place. My kids love it. They've gone there to skateboard. Why have it on the riverfront rather than at Kona, Ellen?
Well, skateboarding is, and you know, I know enough to be dangerous, but don't ask me to dip into a pool on a skateboard either. you know, basically the type of skateboarding at Kona is different from the type of skateboarding, even though you're on the same board. The tricks and the type of tricks, I guess is the best way to say it, is different. And so you have a lot of bowl skating, and you've been there, Melissa, and mm-hmm. kind of like swimming pool and all that. Street league skateboarding is more doing tricks on park benches and rails and all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Very similar in nature, but it is a different technicality from what I've been told. So I can do neither. So I'm just going on what the experts
yeah,
have told
me too.
But
no way am I trying that.
That's right. But what we do want to happen is the Ramos family, who has owned Kona forever, Marty Ramos, we want this to help accentuate their park. They've done a magnificent job and provided thousands and thousands of kids over the years, you know, great opportunities there. And so we want to use, even though it may not be technical enough, we want to use this event on the river to really bolster up Kona Skate Park into being the park that we all, you know, continue to want it to be. So while they're similar, they're different in kind of expertises.
You're a big believer, too, in using these kinds of high-profile, large-scale sporting events as economic development, and you have a lot of professional expertise with that. So what's your hope for how this event and others can really bring more money, bring more buzz and attention to Jacksonville?
That's a great question. I mean, I think what we're going to see is November, traditionally, the Jaguars are out of town this weekend. And November traditionally is slower in tourism. The hotels aren't as full. The restaurants, you know, that rely on tourism visitors aren't as full. And so the goal in this is, I mean, we've heard already since the announcement from people all over the world that want to book their plane tickets to come watch this event. And so I think what we're going to see is not only people from Jacksonville very interested in it, but you're going to see people from all over the world coming, staying in Jacksonville for, if you're coming from overseas, probably a week. If you're coming from other parts of the country, probably 3 or 4 days. They're going to be booking hotels. They're going to be eating in our restaurants, shopping in our stores, all of that. So it stimulates the economy over that week or weekend. But then in addition to that, people that are watching the stream and then watching the national broadcast and international broadcast are going to see Jacksonville in a whole new light. We're not going to be known for just one sport or two sports. We're now known for a lot of different great sporting events. And so, you know, that's how you grow a city is
yeah.
through showing you can host major events. So I think it will be a great opportunity.
And how can, in the little bit of time we have left, how can people get their tickets?
So we will come out in probably the next couple of weeks. We're finishing the building on a CAD of the stadium. Once we have that, then we'll release the ticket sales. So it'll be in the next couple of weeks. So if you're listening, you're very interested in buying tickets, be on the lookout through Airstream Ventures, through SLS Skate. We'll do a big story on it of where you can buy tickets, and we hope that everybody comes out and supports it.
Check it out this November, the Street League Skateboarding Super Crown Downtown. Alan Verlander, CEO of Airstream Ventures, behind it all. Have fun with it, Alan.
Thanks, Melissa. Talk to you soon.
And in a moment, the Jacksonville Music Experience expands online and in your ears. Plus, we've got some Amazon Echoes to give away. That's next.
Congaree & Penn, dedicated to agriculture and culinary endeavors, offering field-to-fork dining and outdoor experiences on over 300 acres. Sip, dine, explore. Information at congareeandpenn.com. Florida Department of Environmental Protection believes that Florida's coral reef is purely and uniquely Florida and needs to be protected. Abundant with marine life, Florida's coral reef provides vital economic support for coastal communities. More at floridascoralreef.org.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. As infection rates drop and vaccine rates rise, some people are getting back to the gym.
Obviously, I'm coming a little bit more now, just because I've been vaccinated, so I feel a lot better about it.
While others have discovered the convenience of working out at home, what's the future of fitness? Next time on Here and Now.
Today at 2. on WJCT News 89.9.
On the next Fresh Air, how ransomware became a big business and a national security threat. We talk with Michael Schwartz, one of the New York Times investigative reporters who got access to secret communications showing how the Russian-speaking cyber gang DarkSide attacked the Colonial Pipeline and provided tech support for other hackers. Join us
today at noon on WJCT News 89.9.
For 3 decades, he ran the country's biggest police departments. But for all his years as America's top cop, Bill Bratton says no single individual has done more harm to the profession than Derek Chauvin.
He did so much damage to the American police profession, damage to the profession around the world.
Commissioner Bill Bratton on fighting crime and what it'll take to build back trust. Next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. Well, we are spinning great music from local artists right now, courtesy of WJCT's JME, the Jacksonville Music Experience. And this month, we're expanding JME with a new online platform dedicated to local music and curation. We're even giving away some Amazon Echoes for you to listen and enjoy the JME. Our regular musical contributor, Matt Shaw, is on the line with more about all of that and some summer listening he's chosen just for us. Hi, Matt.
Hi, Melissa. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. Of course, we launched the Jacksonville Music Experience last year, a brand new radio station, a brand new platform. This month, we are expanding our online platform with new features, weekly updates, a team of feature contributors, including yourself. People need to check it out at wjct.org/jacksmusic. There's so much going on there. And in a moment, we'll tell you about our Amazon Echo giveaway. But first, Matt, let's explain how JME is a way to listen not just to artists from all over the country and the world, but local artists too.
Yeah, we're really, hyper-focused on the local scene, even though we will cover expanded topics, broader topics from around the world in music. We're drilling down on music reviews, got curated playlists, weekly live music recommendations to see things locally, and then long form features, which I kind of touched on earlier, which are will include profiles of local artists, local music history, and think pieces that kind of provide context of about the state of music today and how the local scene kind of reflects new and changing dynamics in music.
Go to WJCT.org/jacksmusic or just go to jacksmusic.org and check it all out. Okay, so let's listen now. Who are we listening to this month?
Yeah, so I want to shout out our contributors, Hostway Cruz, Dan Brown, Glenn Van Dyke, Shelton Hall, Giella, Al Pete, and the famous David Luckin. One of the things we'll be doing regularly is putting our heads together and drawing on all the experience that these contributors have to curate lists of local artists that you should know. The first one we did that we launched the site with was 5 emerging Jacksonville hip-hop artists that you should know. And we poured through dozens and dozens of artists locally, went through several rounds of culling this list. And this artist, Alana, is one of the young up-and-coming hip-hop artists that we singled out for the list. She's in her early 20s. She's known for her, she's got a penchant for bravery in her lyrics. She leans towards the progressive end of the hip-hop spectrum. So I wanted to listen to the last part of Alana's track, One of You, so you can hear kind of this artist, the highlights of her background in poetry. So let's listen to that track.
And go back to where you came from, take me back there then. Ancestry.com, yeah, I wish I knew my roots, but I accept that I'm the scene. I sit and watch what I'ma do. Stack up on my wealth and I'ma stock up on the tools. After I apply the pressure, pass it down to you know who. It's a lot going on, ayy. Marvin Gaye, I can't sleep in my home, ayy. Little boy holding a toy at the stove, ayy. I'm too afraid to say goodbye to my home, ayy. Look, they falling one by one, two by two, three by three.
All right, that's Alana. Tell us a little bit about the next cut. We're a little tight on time, but tell us about Beach Town, Matt.
Yeah, so this is from an artist, singer-songwriter named Rickolas. He's got an album called Bones that kind of chronicles his experience growing up in Jacksonville Beach. And we interviewed for the site, we interviewed author Donnie Walton of the final revival of Opal and Nev, which is this kind of critical smash. I know you interviewed Donnie a couple months ago. And her book focuses in on music, the fictional account of music, and a lot of the characters in her book were inspired by her experiences going to Einstein Agogo, which is a famous venue in Jack's Beach. And so Einstein is kind of having this moment right now. And so I wanted to listen to Beach Town, which Rickolas, he references Einstein Agogo throughout the album, but in this song as well. So let's listen to that track.
Let the spray paint cans, but we never got a car. We were somewhere between up and down. Growing up in a run-down beach town. Somewhere between up and down. We grew up in a run-down beach town. Somewhere between up and down. We grew up in a run-down beach town. Yeah, somewhere between up and down.
I like that. That's nice. Okay,
yeah, very Springsteen-esque.
Yeah, exactly. Now, before we listen to your last cut to close things out, let me promote heavily our Amazon Echo giveaway campaign to encourage music lovers in Northeast Florida to sign up to receive JME music updates. Sign up for the JME newsletter and enter the giveaway. We are going to be giving away two Amazon Echoes this week and next week. This runs through June 22nd. If you want a free Amazon Echo, go to jacksmusic.org. Sign up to get the newsletter and enter the giveaway. We're just so excited about the expanded Jacksonville music experience. Again, jacksmusic.org. Sign up there to get your Amazon Echo. 1 minute left, Matt. Let's close out quickly with your final cut.
Yeah, I think we have queued up Ain't She Sweet, which is performed on ukulele by Paul McCartney, George
Harrison. Oh, nice. Okay. We'll close with that.
I included it in our five important ukulele performances to promote Jake Shimabukuro's.
All righty. And we're not to cut you off, but we're very tight. Let's listen to that.
Thanks.
And thank you, Matt Shaw. JacksMusic.org, everybody. Have a great day.
I repeat, don't you think she's kind of sweet, me? I'll ask you very confidentially, ain't she sweet? Ain't she sweet? Ain't she sweet?
Let's go.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.